The Mark Steele Revolution, a series of lectures on revolution. This week, the American Civil War.
Aha, you're all thinking. He's run out of revolutions, so he's cheating with a civil war. Next, he'll just do anything that he thinks he knows about. By the end of the series, it'll go, a series of lectures on revolutions. This week, how to make a rice pudding. But I'm going to argue that the American Civil War was in every sense a revolution, which is not the impression you'd get if you learnt about the subject from Hollywood films of the 1930s.
Why, there you go, Miss Sophie, the blackberry pie with pumpkin sauce.
Why, thank you, Rosie. Well, now, you've been such a good maid. Why don't you take all my clothes and money, and from now on, have freedom and vote?
Oh, there you go again with your silly talk, Miss Sophie. Us happy Negro folk ain't got time to go worry ourselves with owning land and voting.
Nor would you get the idea of a revolution from the endless books and programs and lectures about the Civil War that are obsessed with military maps covered in curved arrows that read like the confusing bits from the World Cup panel.
Well, you have to say, Alan, General Hooker should have played a sweeper system, drawing their defence out of midfield and exploiting the Confederates' weak left flank.
Oh, I disagree, Jimmy. I mean, look at this here. He's got a whole regiment free on the right with no one backmarking. And what happens? The cavalry's caught in the offside trap.
From the way people from the deep south are portrayed in more modern films, you can't help thinking there was bound to be a civil war just because every white person who lives south of Kansas is just mad.
No, sir, I've never been seen that there person you're talking about, officer, sir. I never did see nobody get dragged into an underground hideout there, sir, by a bunch of inbred, cross-eyed, crazy people playing banjo, sir.
So what was the Civil War about? Well, at one point, America had, of course, been governed by Britain, which is why when I was 8, my teacher could tell us that we gave America back. So then all the kids went round for days afterwards going, oh, what idiot done that then? Now, after independence from Britain, the 13 colonies that had made up America moved towards being a single nation. But the new nation was driven above all by one idea, expansion. But every time a new state was added, an old row surfaced. What sort of state should it be? Should it aim at industrialisation, like the North, or farming, like the South? Above all, should each new state be founded on the basis of free labour or of slavery? Everything in the South revolved around slavery and cotton. The status of every family depended on the number and quality of slaves they owned. Slaves were quite literally bought and sold as human possessions.
We've gone crazy, crazy, crazy with bargains, bargains, bargains in this year's summer sale at World of Slaves. 6 foot solid muscled cotton pickers, $12.99. Reliable housemates, only $10.99. Say goodbye to your crop worries and hurry, hurry, hurry to World of Slaves.
Branches at Enfield, Croydon, Brent Cross and Charleston.
For a slave, the working hours would be sunrise to sundown, with a 2-hour break for a siesta. They weren't allowed to leave the plantation, weren't allowed to read, weren't allowed to attend Sunday school or to dance. Slaves could be lashed for any reason, and there was no procedure of complaint if they were killed. Half of all slave children were taken from their parents to be sold on, breaking up families forever, so that thousands of black people born into slavery were still searching for their families right up until the 1930s. Which is why whenever you see Vivian Leigh in Gone with the Wind screaming when the house is on fire, you should say, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. The problem America had been pondering for 40 years was how to keep the two sides of the nation together. Now, a line had been drawn across the country in a deal known as the Missouri Compromise. The idea was that every new state formed below that line would be a slave state, every new state formed above that line would be a free labour state. But the compromise didn't work. The South was forever trying to push its boundaries upwards. For example, in 1850, the South forced the passing of a law called the Fugitive Slave Law, which meant that any ex-slave who'd fled and was living in the North could now be legally tracked down and returned to their master like lost property. But the new law backfired on the South, as it brought the whole issue of slavery to most Northerners. The abolition movement, up to then quite small, started to grow rapidly, and groups were formed in most towns. Then throughout the 1850s, the rows in Congress between North and South on the slave issue became more and more heated, regularly breaking out into fistfights and eventually getting so bad that one abolitionist, Charles Sumner, was beaten with a cane and couldn't return to the Senate for 3 years. Now, this is quite hard to imagine when you're British, because you can't really think what it would be like to have a fight in Parliament.
The Prime Minister.
I say to the leader of the party opposite, you're a toilet.
Do you want some or what?
Leader of the opposition.
Is the Prime Minister aware that I can have him any time I want? And furthermore, I know where you live.
A woman called Harriet Tubman formed an organisation which hid slaves and spirited them to sanctuary in Canada, which became known as the Underground Railroad. Though if you were trying to flee your master, I'm not sure you'd have much confidence if the escape route was called the Underground. You'd be thinking, I'll just get to Canada and then go, oh no, the machine won't take me ticket! And then if you cross the border at Niagara Falls, there's a tannoy system going, mind the gap! But there was one abolitionist who made the biggest impact of all. In 1812, a young boy had been invited into a landlord's house and while there made friends with a black boy. At night, the landlord went out to the slave and beat him with a shovel. And the slave's young friend was John Brown. As Brown grew up, he became determined to oppose slavery and helped fleeing slaves escape. In the 1850s, his wool business collapsed and he moved to Kansas with some of his 20 sons. In Kansas, Brown met up with groups of runaway slaves to form an anti-slavery campaign. Slave owners had killed 5 abolitionists in Kansas, so one night with a group of 7 others, including 4 of his sons, he went into Pottawatomie Creek, abducted 5 slave owners, and killed them with a broadsword. Pro-slavery Kansas, as you can imagine, went berserk.
Good evening, and welcome to Crime Watch. Tonight we report on the horrific murders in Pottawatomie Creek.
It was an ordinary day on an ordinary plantation. Until, that is, a group of men arrived on horseback carrying broadswords. Did you see them? Were you one of them?
Maybe they stopped off for a pint on the way back. Were you in a pub in Kansas that night when the abolitionists came in on horseback carrying blood-covered broadswords?
Brown then devised a plan to attack Harper's Ferry, which was part of a county with 10,000 slaves. With a small army of ex-slaves and abolitionists, he captured the town, but the backup took longer to arrive than he planned, and as word got out, the pro-slavery citizens of the area surrounded Brown and his troops, and they were overpowered. Brown was captured and sentenced to death. And when a southern priest was sent to say prayers at his execution, he said,
I would not insult God by bowing down in prayer with anyone who had the blood of the slave on his skirts.
The story of John Brown swept across America, south and north. To abolitionists, he was their hero, especially after a quartet from the Boston Infantry wrote the famous song about him. But to the south, he was a symbol of everything they hated about the north.
Good evening. With me on this special Crime Watch update is Inspector Anderton from Kansas CID.
Thank you, Sue. Well, obviously, it's good news that thanks to your help, John Brown has been captured, tried and executed. But we would, however, like to remind the public that his body does still lie a-mouldering in the grave and are concerned that his soul may go marching on.
The two halves of America were growing more and more irreconcilable. Uncle Tom's Cabin, published at this time, became a best-selling book and had such an effect in turning people against the idea of slavery that years later, when Abraham Lincoln met its author, Harriet Beecher Stowe, he said,
So you're the woman who started this war.
Lincoln himself had been a clerk and a shopkeeper and a railway worker. He became a lawyer and a member of the Whig Party, and when that collapsed in 1854, he joined the Republican Party, which replaced it. He was their ideal candidate to stand for president in 1860, but not because he was a fierce opponent of the South, but because he was the perfect compromise with the South. He'd always opposed slavery, but in his speeches as candidate, he was adamant that he didn't support equal rights and joked that,
Just because I don't want a Negro woman to be a slave doesn't mean I want one for a wife.
The other thing about him which made him seem less threatening to the South was that he was completely weedy. He was a poor speaker, and when he won the election, he wasn't able to make his inaugural speech because he'd lost his satchel with his notes in. On his first day in the White House, he was probably going, Sir, the Democrats keep hitting me with a ruler. Lincoln beat the Democrats in the 1860 election, but even a theoretical opponent of slavery was more than the South could stand. So over the next 6 weeks, South Carolina, Mississippi, Louisiana, Georgia, Texas, Florida, and Alabama all left the United States, and they elected their own president, Jefferson Davis. A large part of the Southern Army was stationed at a place called Manassas on the border with Virginia, and Lincoln ordered an attack. Northerners had so much confidence that the rebels would quickly be put in their place that thousands of people turned up to the battle in wagons to support the North and settled down to spectate with a picnic. Only in America could you have a battle like that.
Burgers, hot dogs, popcorn.
Can I see your ticket, sir? Ah, block G07, that's just down there on the left.
You're going home in a military ambulance.
Oh, these are good seats, honey. We'll get a lovely view of the bayonet charge.
For half a day, the Union Army forced the Confederate troops back, but one Confederate commander, Thomas Jackson, was keeping his forces steadier than the others, earning him the nickname Stonewall. Stonewall Jackson, apart from being a great general, was also fanatically religious. He sucked lemons, one after the other, all day, and was obsessive about avoiding pepper, as he was convinced it made his left leg itch. So when he was told, "Here, we've got a nickname for you, Stonewall Jackson," he must have thought, "Bloody hell, that's a result." But sure, it was Flea Legs Loony Jiff Face Jackson. During the afternoon of the battle, reinforcements arrived for the south, and thousands of rebel soldiers broke through the Union lines to come running over the hill with a piercing shriek that became known as the Confederate Yell. The Union army was completely routed. By 1862, 18 months into the war, the Union was suffering defeat after defeat. Why was the North doing so badly? Well, the answer, I think, is summed up in the career of one man, George McClellan. General George McClellan had achieved one of the highest ever grades at the West Point Military Academy, and after the Battle of Manassas was made commander of the Union armies. But at his first chance of attacking the South, he got his army into position and then decided not to attack because, he said,
"The enemy have 3 to 4 times our force."
Although fellow officers estimated that Confederates had half the forces of McClellan. He declined one battle because he could see the enemy had hordes of cannons, though when someone investigated, they turned out to be logs painted black. How did he save face when this came out? Did he try and say, "Well, you can't be too careful"? I mean, I heard about a regiment once that was completely wiped out by a battalion of twigs. Lincoln was writing to McClellan desperately, saying in one letter,
"I beg to assure you I have never written in greater kindness, but you must act."
But then, finding himself across the River Potomac and into Confederate territory, completely outnumbering the army of Robert Lee, McClellan again refused to attack. This time he told Lincoln,
"My horses are fatigued."
In other words, McClellan was the biggest pub fight bullshitter in history. You do hear blokes who say, "I'd have taken them on, honey, there was 9 of them." But he was going, 135,000 of them, weren't they, right? "I'd have taken a lot of them on, only my horse was knackered, see?" How could this brilliant military leader with an exemplary record, who inspired devotion amongst all his men, be so useless? As the war developed, the reason became clear. The slaves understood the nature of the war in a way that few leaders of the Union did. Whenever a Union army was in the neighbourhood, slaves would escape their plantations and join up with the army. And then certain commanders began to realise that because the blacks knew the area better than they did, they could be crucial for providing intelligence. So General O.M. Mitchell wrote to Lincoln in 1862,
"I have this day written to you of the absolute necessity of protecting slaves who furnish us with valuable information. My riverfront is 120 miles long. Without the assistance of Negroes, I would have to abandon my position."
Similar accounts were coming in from every camp, including one from the Rappahannock River near Fredericksburg in Virginia. A runaway slave called Dabney arrived at the army camp and was employed as a cook, but was obviously an expert on the area. But what the commanders couldn't work out was that he always knew exactly where the Confederate armies would be marching the day before it happened. So the Union General Hooker started to act on Dabney's advice, and for weeks afterwards the Confederates found that everywhere they went, they'd be ambushed by Union soldiers who knew in advance where they were going. Eventually, Dabney explained to one of Hooker's men how he always knew. To do this, he took him to a point where there was a clear view of Fredericksburg and pointed out a cabin near the riverbank with a clothesline with clothes hanging out to dry. And then, according to Hooker's account, Dabney said,
"You see my wife? She washes for the officers. And as soon as she hears about any movement, she moves the clothes. That gray shirt stands for General Longstreet. When she takes it off, it means he's heading for Richmond. The red shirt is Stonewall Jackson. And if he moves, she'll move the red shirt. Two blankets pinned together means ignore the movement of General Lee. It's just a decoy."
The Confederates must have thought his wife was a crap washerwoman, though. "Why didn't you take a big grey shirt off for? It's still soaking wet." "Oh, I wasn't thinking." Black newspapers were being circulated, urging slaves to run off and fight for the Union. Injured Northern soldiers were taken in and protected by slaves. But possibly the greatest of them all was William Tilghman. He was a Northern black who was a cook on the S.J. Waring, a boat bound for South America from New York. A Confederate captured the boat and killed the crew, except for three. A German steersman, a Yankee who he put in irons, and Tilghman, the cook, who was told that he would be taken to Charleston to be sold as a slave. That night, he pondered the situation, thought about his future life as a slave, and decided to arm himself with a club. After that, he went into the captain's room and struck him dead. Then he did the same to the second in command. Then he went up on deck and struck the mate and seized his revolver. He drove the whole crew below deck, released the Yankee, and put the Confederates in irons. Then he turned the ship back towards New York, and finally, when he got the boat back there, the government awarded him $6,000 as prize money for the capture of the schooner. Now, I'm sure that one day this is going to be a Hollywood film. Except that you can imagine how a writer would have to sell it to the studios.
I'm telling you, Mr. Warner, it's Mississippi Burning meets Titanic. The Yankee's going to be Julia Roberts. She spends most of the movie in chains. It's pure sex. And okay, we couldn't get Denzel to play Tilghman, but we got the next best thing sitting right here with me. Go on, son, do your big line.
Hasta la vista, Confederates.
Every slave that ran to the Union was a double victory, one less producer of cotton for the South and one more supporter of the Northern Army. So Lincoln passed a Confiscation Act which made all property used in rebellion subject of capture. Lincoln himself began to transform. He became a forthright supporter of abolition and a forceful speaker, answering his critics by winding them up completely, saying,
"If I have to free some of the slaves to save the Union, I shall. And if I have to free all of the slaves to save the Union, I shall."
Now it makes sense why McClellan was so useless. McClellan was a Democrat, and Northern Democrats had been anxious not to appear as if they supported blacks in any way. In a letter to a friend, he'd written,
"I am fighting to preserve the integrity of the Union. To that end, we cannot afford to mix up the Negro question. Help me to dodge the nigger. I want nothing to do with him."
And I bet he still followed it up with, "Mind you, I'm not a racist. Some of my best mates are slaves." See, McClellan's heart just wasn't in the fight. He respected the South, and he certainly didn't want to destroy their way of life. So Lincoln sacked him. Slaves began to escape in masses to sign up for the Union Army, and from then to the end of the war, 179,000 of them joined up. At first, some recruiting stations were told to close down if they were recruiting blacks. And in Cincinnati, the proprietor of a black recruiting station was told by the police,
"Keep out of this. This is a white man's war."
Now, it's worth thinking for a minute what was happening here. Thousands of men were turning up to say, "We demand the right to march 30 miles a day through disease-ridden forests, crawl through a river and get shot out by a horde of shrieking madmen." And then recruiting officers were saying, "Well, we're not going to let you. That's our privilege." You can't help thinking that there must have been some white officers who ended up face down in the mud thinking, "Have we got this the wrong way round?" Even when blacks were admitted into the army, at first they were used just to cook and dig trenches. And you can be certain that when Lincoln ordered that they should be allowed into fighting units, there'll have been some people going, "Oh, God, these days. Now it's illegal to make them dig trenches. I'll tell you, it's political correctness gone mad." Even then, black soldiers were paid $10 a month minus clothing, whereas white soldiers were paid $13. It's a shame Gordon Brown wasn't there, really. He'd have sorted that out. He'd have said, "That's outrageous. There should be another rate of $3 for teenagers." Now, there was opposition to emancipation in the northern towns, but that opposition was fatally undermined by two events in the same week in 1863. Firstly, the Irish in New York were terrified that ex-slaves would take their jobs, and so a great many of them rioted against blacks, and they set fire to a black orphanage. Most northerners were horrified, although South London police probably said that they saw no reason to suspect there might be a racist motive. Public reaction to this atrocity was that opinion swung further behind Lincoln and emancipation. But the other event took place at Fort Wagner near Charleston. An all-black regiment called the 54th Massachusetts had been formed under the command of an abolitionist called Robert Shaw. At that point, very few blacks had been sent into battle as the whites simply didn't trust them. And then the order came for the 54th Massachusetts to lead the assault on the fort. Every account agreed that the company was extraordinarily courageous, almost capturing the fort against impossible odds, although almost the entire company was wiped out and Robert Shaw himself was killed. From then on, the black troops were a fundamental part of the Union Army. Meanwhile, the war was bringing about a number of new inventions. The Confederates built the first ever submarine to see action, the CSS Hunley, although the first three times that this submarine set off, it sank and drowned the entire crew. The fourth time, it did sink a Union ship, but then it sank again. Which does make you think, how did they get a crew to sign up for the fourth time? Did they just go, no need to worry, we found the Ford, it's a bit of a screw lodge there, steady as a rock now, if we're right. And then loads of people went, okay, I believe you. It'd be like if Richard Branson said to you, would you like to join me for a ride in a balloon? Dozens of songs like John Brown's Body, Battle Cry for Freedom and Dixieland were immortalised by the war. Whereas if it had been in England, the songs would have just been, one A.B. Lincoln, there's only one A.B. Lincoln. By the summer of 1863, the North was beginning to turn the tide, but the South had only to hang on. Their hope was that they would win diplomatic recognition from abroad, especially Britain, who bought almost all of their cotton. Though there's probably another reason why the British establishment supported the South. When abolitionists said to them, but the slaves get whipped, they must have thought, what, for free? Prime Minister Lord Palmerston did back the South, but he stopped short of military intervention, whereas if it had been Blair, he'd have said, well, say what you will about slavery, it certainly helps get people off of benefits and into work. In America itself, the logic of making slavery the central issue of the war was becoming apparent in two ways to Lincoln. Firstly, that instead of this Confiscation Act, which still left slavery legal in the states which hadn't broken from the Union, he pledged to abolish slavery throughout the whole country. The plan was to announce emancipation following the next military victory. And as luck would have it, the armies of the Confederate General Lee and the Union's General Meade were approaching each other at Gettysburg. 45,000 died in the three-day battle at Gettysburg. Although the casualties at Gettysburg were enormous on both sides, there was no doubt that they were far worse for the South and that the rebel states were completely demoralised. Whereas in the North there was rejoicing and the headline in the Philadelphia Inquirer was Waterloo eclipsed. Now you must imagine that there was probably a budding tabloid writer there going, what about stick it up your Dixie? But Gettysburg was celebrated for another reason. After the battle, Abraham Lincoln arrived and made a speech which became famous as the speech which spurred the North on to victory and was known as the Gettysburg Address. The irony of the speech is that according to some accounts, like that of Lincoln's friend, Wald Hill Lehman, he sat down afterwards and was convinced it was a failure. In discussion amongst the other speakers, everybody agreed that the Gettysburg Address had gone flat, which is brilliant that at the end of the most dramatic speech in history, the bloke who'd made it was thinking, I knew I should have started with a knob joke. In the aftermath of Gettysburg, Lincoln did pass the Emancipation Act, and he made it known that his enemy was now not just the Confederate Army, but the whole of Southern slave society. In other words, he was in a war that up till then had wiped out 300,000 people, and then he said, right, from now on, no more Mr. Nice Guy. Progress was still slow, but eventually one of the North's most prominent soldiers, General Sherman, captured Atlanta, the most important town in the South, apart from Richmond. The new philosophy meant that Sherman set about destroying the whole city. In Mississippi, the army of Ulysses Grant was leaving every area it captured just as desolate, especially as the army was feeding itself by foraging the countryside. The historian Bruce Catton wrote that at one point an irate planter rode up to Grant on a mule to complain that his troops had robbed him of everything he owned. Grant looked him in the eye and said,
those men can't have belonged to my division, because if they were my men, they wouldn't have left you that mule.
Back in the North, George McClellan was standing against Lincoln in the presidential election. His newspaper claimed that if Lincoln won a second term,
sweet-scented sambos will nestle in the bosom of every abolition woman.
I expect McClellan got a television series of his own after that from producers saying, oh, he was only being ironic. Lincoln announced another proclamation which would constitutionally end slavery forever. Sheets with the proclamation on were distributed in the streets of Washington and a black pastor called Henry Turner grabbed the first batch. He ran for a mile, followed by a huge crowd who wanted to see what was on it, until he got to a platform in Pennsylvania Avenue and climbed up to read it out. But he was so out of breath that he had to pass it to a friend to read out instead, at which point he says,
men squealed, women fainted, dogs barked, white and coloured people shook hands, songs were sung and cannons began to fire at the Navy Yard.
Which sounds marvellous, except I'm not sure you can include dogs barking as part of the rejoicing. That's just a typical dog owner, I reckon. I bet if you heard the tape, there'd be this fantastic celebration and of this marvellous turning point in history, and in the background, Oi, Princess! Over here now! Meanwhile, Sherman's army arrived in Charleston, and the Confederates were made to surrender the town to the colonel of a black regiment. And Ulysses Grant's army arrived in Richmond to force the final surrender and the end of the South's rebellion. Cabins where slaves had been locked in for the examination of purchasers were opened and the slaves were freed. And one report told of a scene that, if you could visit any point in history, must be one of the favourites. A soldier marching through the town saw a group of Confederate prisoners being led away when he noticed that among them was his old master. Quietly, he walked across to him and said, Hello, master. Bottom rail on top this time. The war wasn't just a war, it was a revolution. What is a revolution but a transformation in the way that society produces for itself? In the battle between these two incompatible systems, slavery lost. Revolutions are also different from most wars because they involve uprisings, which is the second reason why the South lost. Because what else is the fleeing of 500,000 slaves, nearly 200,000 of them taking up arms, joining with dedicated abolitionists to transform an army into an ideological force, but a revolution? Only when Lincoln understood that society had to be transformed could the war be won. In the week that the war ended, Abraham Lincoln went to the opera. A Confederate called John Wilkes Booth was in the audience, and he assassinated Lincoln. It was especially unlucky for Lincoln to be shot at the opera, because he'd have been going, I've been shot! And the audience will all have thought, oh, what a marvellous baritone. In the years following the war, southern landowners made statements about how they'd learnt from their mistakes and realised that they'd become out of touch with their slaves, though they clearly didn't really regret a thing. I'm sure somewhere there's a Confederate who said, and because we've listened to the people, we're now going to make a fresh start and appoint to the shadow cabinet Cecil Parkinson and Anne Widdecombe. But mostly the Civil War changed society forever, not just by keeping America unified, but by showing that people as far down in society as possible could rise up to defeat their owners to change history. And if they can do it, then so can anybody. The Civil War changed society forever because of people like the unnamed ex-slave who on the day of emancipation addressed the Union camp.
Once the time was, I cried all night. The next morning, my child was to be sold, and she was sold. And I never expect to see her till the day of judgment. Now, no more that. No more that. They can't sell my wife and child, no more. No more that. No more that. We're free now. Bless the Lord.
The Mark Steele Revolution was written and presented by Mark Steele with the help of Carla Mendonca and Martin Heider. The producer was Phil Clark.